So the usual rules apply. I will let you know when the quizzes are done and you can come pick them up at the usual spot. If you haven't been picking them up, you don't know what the usual spot is, and I'm not going to fill you in right now. So you can always go and check to see where they left. Okay, could I have your attention, please? Couple of things. One is your final exam. I sent you the times. It's on the 11th. It's 2 days after your last class. There's really no excuse for leaving the country between the last class and the final exam. It's not like it's in the following week. So I would like you to take the final exam in person in the classroom. So plan to be in New York on the 11th. If you, for whatever reason, you get sick, of course, there'll be a backup plan. But the plan should be that you're going to take the exam in class. So let's talk about option pricing. Remember the two building blocks for option pricing models? Replication and arbitrage. Replication basically means you can create a portfolio of the underlying asset and borrowing or lending that has the same cash flows as the comp. Arbitrage basically requires that they trade at the same price. The easiest way to see this in practice is to use what's called a binomial model. Sounds fancy, but in a binomial model, your stock price can go to only one of two points. So let's take an example. Let's suppose your stock right now is at 50. It can go to either 70 or 35 in the next time period. In the following time period, if you start at 70, it can either go up to 100 or drop to 50. If it's at 35, it can jump to 50 or 25. So basically at each point, the stock can jump to only one of two points. It's a very restrictive model, but it's going to allow us to see both replication and arbitrage play out. So here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to combine borrowing and buying the underlying stock to have exactly the same cash flows as the call. So I'll give you the call that we're going to try to value. It's a call with a strike price of 40. So we're at point zero. The stock is at 50. I give you a call with a strike price of 40. If you exercise the call right away, how much money are you going to make on this call? So strike price is 40, which means you get the right to buy at 40. The stock price is 50. If you exercise right away, the exercise value of this call is going to be $10. But you're not going to exercise today because you have time left on the option. Here's what can happen. Stock could go to up to 100, could drop to 25. Let's see what the call cash flows are at each of these prices. Remember, your strike price is still 40. The stock price goes to 100. How much money are you going to make? You're going to buy at 40, sell at 100, you're going to make 60. If it goes to 50, you're going to buy at 40, sell at 50, you're going to make 10. If it goes to 25, why aren't you buying at 25, selling at 40 and losing 15? Because you have the right to do it. You don't have an obligation. The stock goes to 25, guess what you do? You take the option, you throw it in the trash can, say, I wish I hadn't bought it. So have the cash flows in the call. Here's what I'm going to try to do now. I'm going to combine borrowing and buying the stock to get exactly the same cash flows as the call. So let's say the stock is at 70. You want to create a portfolio that replicates the call. You need to borrow some money. You need to buy some shares of stock. You don't know how much of each. So let's set this up like an algebra problem. Let's say you borrow B dollars and you buy delta shares of stock. Sounds abstract, but hang in there. If you borrow B dollars, and let's say the interest rate is 11%, and you hold it for one period, stock goes to 100, that position is going to be 100 times delta, whatever number of shares you bought, minus the borrowing paid back with interest. That's what the 1.11 times B is. And that position has to have the same cash flows as the call, which is 60. So the stock goes to 100, that position has a cash flow of 60. If the stock goes to 50, 50 times delta minus 1.11B has to be equal to 10. Remember way back in high school, we had simultaneous equations. Two equations, two unknowns. If you work hard enough and long enough, they should become knowns, right? That's what I'm doing. I'm solving for the unknowns. And it turns out that delta is equal to one and B is equal to $36.04. Now, part of you is saying, what the heck does that even mean? If you go out and borrow $36.04 and buy one share of stock, you will have a position that has exactly the same cash flows as the call. Think of how much it's going to cost you to create that position. Going out and buying one share will cost you $70, but because you borrowed $36.04, you have to come up with only $33.96. So you to create the replicating portfolio, it'll cost you $33.96. But remember, arbitrage means that the call, which has the same cash flows, has to trade at exactly the same price. So I've actually backed out what the value of the call will be if the stock goes to 70. It's going to be $33.96. I repeat that process, the stock goes to 35. I solve for the equations. And it turns out that borrowing $9.01 and buying 0.4 shares of stock, and don't ask me how you do that, but let's say you could, will give you exactly the same cash flows as the call. That position will cost you $4.99. And by extension, by arbitrage, the call has to trade at $4.99. So what's a call going to be worth if the stock goes to 70? It's going to be worth $33.96. And if the stock goes to 35, it's worth $4.99. I go back one time period. You see why you always start at the last period and work back? The last period is the only period where you know what the cash flows and the call are, so you're working backwards. You saw, again, you do the same thing. How much do I need to borrow? B dollars. How many shares do I need to buy? In this case, you set it equal to $33.96 if the stock goes to 70, because that's what the call will be worth. The stock is 70, and $4.99 if the stock goes to 35. You solve for D and B. You borrow $21.61 and buy 0.827 share. It's very difficult to conceptualize buying 0.8278 shares of stock. But if you do that, you will have exactly the same cash flows as the call. That position would cost you $19.42. The call today will trade at $19.42. Now remember, I said if you exercise the call today, you make $10. What's the extra $9.42 called? If you have an option, you pay more than the exercise value. What do people usually call that? It's called a time premium. You're paying because there's time left in the option. You pay more than the exercise value because good things can happen. Bad things can also happen, but remember, you're bounded on the downside. Good things can happen. That's called the binomial model. It didn't come into being till 10 years after the Black-Scholes, which is the model that most people have heard about. But if you take the binomial model, it's a very restrictive model, right? At any point in time, the stock can jump to only one of two prices. To have any chance of this even holding, you got to make time really short, right? If you make time one day, think of all the possible prices that a stock can go to in one day. But if I made it a second, maybe I have a shot of getting the price to only one of two choices. Let's say I could do that. So I draw 1 second time into it. A typical listed option is about 3 months. How many seconds are there in three months? I'm not expecting an answer, but obviously a lot of seconds, right? Let's say you're a very patient, meticulous person. You decide to draw a binomial tree with really tiny branches, 1 second branches for 3 months. So you take a really sharp pencil, you got a magnifying glass, you start to draw these little branches. When you're done, it's going to look really dense, right? All these tiny branches with the numbers filled up. Flip the tree on its base. You know what it starts to look like? It looks like a pine tree without a trunk. Smooth out the outside of that pine tree. Statistically, what am I going to be looking at if I smooth out a pine tree? Pine tree is all sharp edges, but smoothed out, it's going to look like, what's the distribution going to look like if I smooth out the outsides of a pine tree? What's a statistical distribution that actually has that shape of? It's going to be a normal distribution. If you take the binomial distribution, as the time gets shorter, you make price changes also smaller. That's called a continuous price distribution. The binomial distribution becomes the Black-Scholes model. People often talk about the two as separate models. The Black-Scholes is a special case of the binomial model. But it's more difficult in the Black-Scholes to see replication arbitrage. Binomial, you can see it play out at each stage. But what's the upside of replacing the binomial with a normal distribution? Normal distribution can be described with only two parameters, the expected value, the standard deviation. Think of how much less information I need to give you if I, and that's what the Black-Scholes is saying. It's saying, look, You don't want to do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of branches, get the price at each branch. Just assume a normal distribution, but it comes at that cost of assuming that price changes get really small. So let me give you a very quick review of the original Black-Scholes model. As I said, Fisher Black and Marin Scholes in the early 70s derived this model at the University of Chicago. They both won Nobel Prizes for it. And in their model, the value of a call option is a function of five inputs. I list out the five, and as I list them out, I want you to think about what I talked about last session, where I said there were six inputs that drove the value of an option. I want you to think about which input is missing in the Black-Scholes. In the Black-Scholes model, the value of a call is a function of the current stock price, the strike price, the life of the option, the riskless rate, and this question mark is actually a sigma, the standard deviation of the variance in the asset. S, K, T, R, and sigma. What's a missing variable? Remember the sixth variable that I listed that affects the value of an option? If you want, you can turn back the slides and look at what the six variables were. What's one input that I seem to be missing? You don't have the original slides from previous? I think it's like four slides ago, so it can't be that far away. It says, what is it? Interest rate isn't R, is the interest rates. Yeah. Keep going, those six, you have that page in front of you? Yeah, what are the first three variables? Value, variance, and? I've got the value, I've got the variance. Where's the expected dividend? It's not in there. The original Black-Scholes model was designed to value options without dividends. Why? Because the math got too messy. That's basically the reason. They wanted to solve the equation, the math got too messy, so they decided to, it's the classic economist's response to a problem, right? Just assume it away. They said, let's assume no dividends. I don't blame them, math was too messy. The original Black-Scholes was designed to value what are called dividend protected or non-dividend paying options. I'm going to give you a very simple fix to it. But in the original Black-Scholes, if you look at the value of a call option, the value of the call is the current stock price. It's not some expected future stock price times N of D1. I'll come back and talk about what that is. Minus KE minus RT. I tell people, look, when you use the Black-Scholes, there are all these virgin buttons in your calculator you've never touched that you suddenly find yourself using. Remember that exponential button in your calculator? You say, who the heck uses this EXP button or the LN button? Guess what? If you use the Black-Scholes, you're going to be using those inputs. You know what E minus RT is? What that is? K is the strike price. What is E minus RT?
The continuous discount
factor. It's a present value factor. In fact, I tell people, look, if you don't have an exponential button in your calculator, just use the present value equation. You'll get exactly or very close to the same answer. Because the Black-Scholes works in continuous time, you're not, because normally when you do present value, you do 1 plus R raised to the power of T. This is the continuous time version of a present value. You're saying, why am I taking present value? The Black-Scholes option pricing model, again for simplicity, was designed to value what are called European options, which is an unfortunate choice of terms because it suggests it has something to do with geography, right? It has nothing to do with geography. There are two types of options, European options and American options. What sets them apart?
Yeah. European options can only be exercised.
European options can be exercised only at expiration. American options can be exercised anytime up to expiration. Let me ask you a follow-up question. Yeah, you have two options. They have exactly the same characteristics. One is a European option, one is an American option. Which should trade for more?
So I remember that another professor once.
Forget about professors, right? Let's go to common sense. With the European option, he can exercise only at expiration. With an American option, you can do everything he can do plus more, right? Yeah. This is common sense. So basically an American option should trade for more than a European option.
What does it really?
Depends on whether there's a chance of exercise. Okay? The 95% of options get held to expiration. The European option might be close or equal to the American, it'll never be lower.
Yeah.
Okay. So the greater the chance of early exercise, the more the difference is going to be. Okay? So that's so that comes purely from the common sense proposition that an American option gives you more choices than a European option. So you can already see the original Black-Scholes, they made the world simpler because they needed a closed form solution, something they could say, this is the value of a coin. And that's going to come back and become an issue when we use the Black-Scholes model to value real options. You know what? One of the things I'm going to describe as real option is if an oil company has undeveloped reserves. Let's say they have the rights to develop these reserves for the next 20 years. I'm going to value that reserve with the Black-Scholes model. And you know what the pushback should be in the Black-Scholes model?
Real options are like American options.
You can do you don't wait till the last day of the 20th year. Say, I'm going to get all the oil out of the ground now. If oil prices go up in year 12 or 13, you want to develop reserves. You want it to, in fact, a real option, you want to exercise early, right? If you have a patent, and I'm going to argue that's an option, you want to develop the patent. So when you use a Black-Scholes model, it's not that you're getting the wrong value, you're getting a lower bound on the value. The American option will be worth more. And there the difference can be significant because people do exercise early. Now let's talk about ND1 and ND2. To understand ND1 and ND2, take a look at D1 and D2. Again, replace the question mark with a sigma. D1 and D2 are a function of all of those variables that showed up in the original Black-Scholes model. I won't try to give you an intuitive explanation of D1 and D2 because there isn't one. It's a mathematical level. But if I take the D1 and D2, here's what ND1 and ND2 give me. And as I show this page, you're going to start to see the intuition behind ND1 and ND2. So I calculate D1, I calculate D2. I go to what's called a cumulative normal distribution. Now, the reason I emphasize that is if you've taken statistics classes, there's usually a normal distribution that you run into. That gives you the height. A cumulative normal distribution gives you an area. So if you look at the cumulative normal distribution, the lowest value it can take is zero. The highest value is one. Now, in statistics, we have probabilities, right? What's the lowest value probability can have? Can't be below zero. What's the highest value? One. ND1 and ND2 are probabilities. You're saying of what? ND2 has a very specific meaning attached to it. It's the risk neutral probability that S will be greater than K. In other words, that sometime during the life of this option will be exercised. Let me repeat that again. You get an ND2 of 0.80. You're telling me there's an 80% chance that sometime in the next 2 years, which is the option life, this option will be exercised. Hold on to that thought because later when we talk about real options, we're going to draw on this property. What's ND1? It's also a probability, but the difference is set by the standard deviation. It's like a range. Think about it as a range. So if you're absolutely sure there's no sigma, ND1 and ND2 will converge to the same number. But because there's uncertainty, ND1 and ND2 will diverge. But there's more here. A lot of people use the Black-Scholes. They plug the numbers and they get a value and then they throw the model up. But remember the binomial, we created a replicating portfolio by borrowing money and buying shares. Embedded in the Black-Scholes is that replicating portfolio. And let me break out what that replicating portfolio is. To create the call option, and I wanted to replicate the portfolio, I'm going to go out and borrow the present value of the exercise price times ND2. In other words, if there's a very low probability that the option be exercised, I need to borrow less. So that's how much I borrow. And I'm going to buy ND1 shares of stock. If I do that, I've done exactly what I did with the simultaneous equation. I've created a replicating portfolio. That ND1 shares of stock you buy is called the option delta. In fact, if you've ever hung out around people who trade and research options, you don't want to spend too much time around them. But they speak a lot of Greek, not actual Greek, but they use a lot of Greek letters. Delta, gamma, theta, you know, vega. You know what every single one of those Greek letters captures? It captures how the replicating portfolio changes as something changes. For instance, the stock price goes up, the option delta will change. If the standard deviation changes, the option replicating portfolio will change. In fact, the option vega captures how your replicating portfolio will change as the standard deviation changes. The option theta will capture how your replicating portfolio will change as the life of the option changes. So if you keep it simple, you can very quickly see through this Greek because everything is about that replicating portfolio. And we, you know why we care so much about the replicating portfolio? It's not just that we can use it to value options. It's because this is how you decide how to hedge an open option position. If you're an investment bank, you have an open call option position. And I say, guys, you need to hedge it. We're exposed to too much risk. You're going to go out and sell the replicating portfolio, which has the same cash flows. And if you do it right, you've essentially hedged your position. So the original Black-Scholes was designed for dividend protected options. And you can essentially value any dividend protected option using it, with the caveat that it's designed to value European options. So if you have an American option, you're going to come up with a floor. And also given the caveat that price changes are continuous. Let me tell you how the market would look like in a continuous price change world. 2 weeks ago, Twitter was trading at what, 38. Today it's trading at, no, now that Musk is very close, it's trading close to 54.20. You know how Twitter stock price would have gone from 38 to 54 in a continuous price world? They've gone 38, 38.01, 38.02. Prices don't jump in a continuous. Clearly a very unrealistic assumption. But again, the reason they do it is it buys you this normal distribution, which saves you a lot of trouble in terms of, you know, estimating. But it is going to mean that if you use a Black-Scholes model to value an asset where the prices jump around, you're going to undervalue the option. Why? Because for you to get from 38 to 54 in a continuous price world, it takes a lot of work and a lot of time. But the world that we live in, all you need is an acquisition bid. You can go from 38 to 54 very quickly. So with all of that put in, let's talk a little bit about why you cannot be a purist when it comes to option pricing. As I said, most of the real options we're going to value are going to be exercised early. Most of the real options we're going to value will involve price jumps. And if you're a purist, an option pricing purist, if you have an option that can be exercised early and it can have price jumps, a binomial option pricing model is actually better than the Black-Scholes model. But I'll tell you upfront that there isn't a single real option I'm going to value in the next two sessions using a binomial model. You know why? Think of how much information I would need to come up with to develop a binomial model. All those prices for all the branches. So I'm going to be open about the fact that I'm not a purist. I'm going to use the Black-Scholes model, accepting its limitations, because all I want is a rough estimate of value, a sense of, am I paying for something really valuable, or is this something I can ignore? Incidentally, option pricing is one of the most intimidating things you can bring into a conversation. So if you go to work for a bank or a consulting firm, you pull the option pricing model out, I can almost guarantee you that even if this is a finance group, people's eyes will glaze over, because it's got, you know, again, it's the deltas and the gammas and the thetas. So I'm going to make a suggestion. If you don't have to pull the option pricing model out of your toolkit, don't, because there is an alternative. In statistics, you have decision trees. Decision trees look a lot like that binomial tree, but tell me the differences between a decision tree and a binomial tree. There are at least two big differences. What's the first difference between a decision tree and a binomial tree?
Decision tree, you can have more than two.
You can have more than two, so you have a lot more choices. You have four possibilities, you can list them all up. What's the second thing that I need in a decision tree that I don't need in a binomial tree? When I showed you the binomial tree, notice I didn't attach probabilities to the branches. When I do a decision tree, I have to attach probabilities to the branches. If I bring in a decision tree and I do it right, I can get roughly the same value as bringing out an option pricing model. It's much more intuitive, much easier for people to understand. I'm going to give you an example. Let's say I call you in to value a new drug I'm thinking about developing. It's a drug to treat diabetes. So I haven't even started yet. I want you to tell me whether it even makes sense for me to do it. So you're right now, right here in the decision tree, the boxes are choices. You can decide. The circles are probabilities. Fate determines the circles. You get to pick them. So right now you can either develop the drug or not develop the drug. If you decide to test the drug, it's going to cost you some money. There's a 70% chance the drug will succeed. So even before you run the market test, you're saying, hey, given what I know about this drug, I think there's a 70% chance the market test is going to come out success, 30% of failure. If it fails, you're going to stop. That's one of the things about decision trees. Remember, we talked about learning and adaptive behavior. It's built into the decision tree. You're stopping because you say, this isn't going to work out. If it succeeds, you do a follow-up. Then this is a full-fledged, you know, study with the with B. And there are four possible outcomes. So first is, it fails, the big test, in which case, you write off even more. You say, I wish I hadn't even started that. But there are three possible outcomes. The first is this turns out to be a drug that treats both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, which is your best case outcome because it's a much bigger market. It treats only type 2 or only type 1. And then with each one, you finally finish up by saying, if I get success, here's what it'll look like in terms of cash flow. So by the time you're done, you've listed every possible outcome from the drug, you come up with the cash flows, and because your probabilities, you can work them all back to today. And what you get is a present value with the op, with the probabilities built in, is $50.36. That captures exactly what you'd have done with an option pricing model, but it does it with decision trees and probabilities. If you go to work for pharmaceutical companies, decision trees work really well. The reason being, your risk is sequential. You know what I mean by sequential? You got to get through stage one to get to stage two. Decision trees are, in a sense, tailor-made for that kind of risk. So keep it in your back pocket. If you've never done decision trees, I have a small paper on my website on using decision trees. Check it out. It's a very good skill, a very good tool to have in your toolkit. So here's what I'm going to do with all of the real options I'm going to describe to you. I'm going to start and ask the question, is there an option here? I'm going to draw the payoff diagram. Second stop, I'm going to say, is there exclusivity? Because remember, that's what drives value. And third stop, I'm going to ask, can I use a Black-Scholes or an option pricing model? Because remember, to use an option pricing model, I need to be able to replicate and arbitrage. What does that mean? The patent has to be traded, the underlying asset has to be traded, I have to be able to borrow and lend money at the risk-free rate. So you can already see that for every 100 starts that I have, I might do only 5, but actually use an option pricing model. So let's start with options in investment analysis. Somebody remind me again in corporate finance, how we think about a project. So if I said, how do I know whether a project is a good project? In corporate finance, what are we trained to do? Yeah. We project out the cash flows. We look at the initial investment. We come up with an NPV. And what's the rule on NPV?
If it's zero or greater, then it's a good investment.
If greater than zero, you take the project. Less than zero, you reject the project. If it's zero, you're indifferent. So that becomes a dividing line. That's a very good rule. Don't abandon it. But let's take this a step further. You have a negative net present value for a project. Then I offer you a deal. I say, would you like the exclusive rights to this bad project? What's your first reaction? Of course not. What if I make it a bad, risky project? This is going from bad to worse, right? You know why you might pay for the rights to a bad, risky project?
Because there's like optionality and thing. Like
because risk cuts both ways, right? Risk can be up or down. You have the rights, you don't have to develop it. But if you get upside risk, this project could go from being a bad project to a good project. That's why we pay for non-viable technologies, right? If I gave you a technology, this doesn't work right now, and I gave you exclusive rights, it might still be valuable, especially in a business where there's a lot of uncertainty. It's called the option to delay. A project that can be a bad project today can become a good project in the future. Here's a second option that you might be missing with a static analysis. You come up with a negative net present value for your project, but it's a project that puts you in a very big market. Like what? Electric cars, China, artificial intelligence. Before you reject this project, here's what you want to think about. If you had take this project, even though it has a negative net present value, you learn about that business. And if it turns out that you're pretty good at it, guess what? It's opened up this huge potential market. It's your option to expand. And here's the third thing. Let's say the project you're looking at is a big infrastructure project. It's a 30-year project. You did the expected cash flows in the next 30 years. You concluded the NPV was negative. And I said, but wait, what if I gave you a choice at the end of year three, if the cash flows don't measure up, to walk away from this project? That's an option to abandon. You might take a long-term project if I gave you a chance to walk away after 3 years with limited losses. The option to delay, the option to expand, the option to abandon. I'm opening a very dangerous door here in corporate finance, because what am I giving you the license to do? Take a negative net present value project using these options. So I'm going to put you to the test. Before you do this, I want to make sure you're doing the right thing. So let's start with the option to delay. Again, the structure is very simple. When you do a traditional capital budgeting analysis, it's static. It tells you what the net present value is today, and it could be negative. But then I give you the rights to this project for the next 10 years. Let's see why it becomes an option. So you're going to see me do something that you're going to see repeatedly with every option. I'm going to show you the payoff diagram. So you have the right to take the project, and anytime if you do, you got to make that initial investment. That becomes like the strike price. Right now, it's a negative net present value project, so you won't exercise. But remember, you have the rights for the next 10 years. So the present value of the cash flows go up over time. Something good happens. This project could become a positive net present value project. You will take it and claim the NPV. Is it possible that you could be disappointed? You give the right. Yep.
Just like an option would, like it could expire, you know.
Could expire worthless, right? That's an out of the money option. But if you have a portfolio of these projects, maybe enough will pay off that it pays off. I'm going to use this option to delay to talk about how to value a patent. Are you familiar with the patent system in the US? So let's say you come up with a new product, or at least the prototype for a new product. In fact, if you ever watch Shark Tank, what's the first question every one of them asks after you describe it? Have you patented it? And if you haven't, get out of here. Okay. So let's say you've patented it. What do you have? You have the rights to develop this product into a commercial product anytime over, I think the patent life in the US is between 17 and 20 years. So let's say it's 20 years. You have the right. This product might not be viable today. But sometime in the next 20 years, it could be viable. In other words, if I were to think about this in terms of an option, here's how I'd structure it. Let's say that the cost of developing this patent into a commercial product is I. For the moment, let's stick with abstractions, it's I. And let's say the present value of the cash flows, if you develop the patent today, is V. So it'll cost you I to develop the patent. V is the expression. If V is greater than I, you will develop the patent, make the difference. If V is less than I, what will you do? Like any other option, you're going to sit and wait and hope it pays off. Now, if I drew the payoff diagram on this, here's what it'll look like. Converting the patent into a product becomes the equivalent of the strike price. You will do it only if the present value of the cash flows exceeds that strike price, and you'll make the difference. If not, what did you lose? Whatever you spent to get this patent, right? And there are two ways companies get patents. What's the first way you get a patent?
In-house R&D.
You do in-house R&D. So you can think of R&D as the money spent by that. The second is?
Goodwill.
Don't use that word around me. That's an accounting word. It means you could buy the patent or you can bring it in. Ultimately, the accountant might show it as goodwill intent, but who cares what the accountant does? By the time he gets around to it, it's too late anyway. You can either buy it or spend the R&D on it. Could you be disappointed? Absolutely. Like any other out of the money option, you could spend the money on R&D and say, I wish I hadn't done that. So when you think about a patent, the underlying asset here is the drug, the product, whatever you got the patent for. You will develop it only if the present value of the cash flows exceed the cost of converting the patent into a product. And if not, you lose whatever you spend coming up with it. So one of the things I'm going to try to do with every real option is I'm going to try to come up with the inputs that I would need for an option pricing model. Because I want to be ready to go. If you ask me to put a number on your option, I need to come up with these inputs. So let's go down the inputs you would need to value an option. First, you would need to value the underlying asset. What's the value of the underlying asset? If you develop the patent today, don't do any forecasting. If you developed it today, what would your cash flows look like? What's your present value? That becomes the S in the model. Now, as you're doing this, you're going to be complaining, right? About the uncertainty you face, you know? I'm going to say that's a good thing, you have uncertainty. And here's why. The second input I'm going to ask you is, how uncertain are you about the value? What's your standard deviation? Now, normally when you do a capital budgeting project, you get one net present value, right? There's no standard deviation. Is there a way we can finesse capital budgeting to actually get not just a net present value, but also a standard deviation in that NPV? Remember Monte Carlo simulations when we did ExxonMobil? I came up with a value for the company, but then I gave you a distribution. One of the nice things about doing Monte Carlo simulations is, in addition to giving me a present value, you're also going to give me a standard deviation of that value. And that's going to be central to the option idea. The strike price is going to be whatever it costs you to convert the patent into a commercial product, building a factory, hiring a sales force. I'm almost there. I need a life for the option. You know what the life of the option is going to be here? What's your option? It's a patent. Do patents run forever? No, they don't. If you have 18 years left in the patent, that becomes the life of the option. But here's the final thing to consider. Options, if they have no cost to waiting, you never exercise them. And that doesn't make any sense here, right? If you have a patent for 17 years, you don't wait 16 years and 364 days on the last day you develop the patent, because you lose something by waiting. What do you lose? You lose that protection you get from the patent. So if this patent becomes viable, I'm going to introduce a cost of delay. I'm going to use that term. It's like a dividend yield. I'm going to say, look, you've got to factor that in, and it's what's going to cause you to exercise it. So I'm going to try this on an actual patent. Company called Biogen, and this is a long time ago when Biogen was a small biotech company, and it had never developed a drug on its own before. It had developed drugs and it had licensed out other pharma companies, but it had this big blockbuster drug working its way through the pipeline, a drug called Avonex, a drug to treat MS. And I got lucky here because these inputs are usually very difficult to get from the outside if you're looking at a drug. So they just got the patent rights to Avonex, had 17 years left on the patent. They hadn't decided whether to develop or not. And what they'd done was a capital budgeting analysis on Avonex. Have you ever seen a pharma company do this? It's actually a very morbid exercise. So here's what they do. They take the percentage of the population that have MS, so a rough sense of, let's say, 8%, 9%, they come up with that number. They take the percentage of those people who go to a doctor, and it's not 100%. So let's say 90% of the people go to a doctor. You're saying, what about the other 10%? They basically essentially have MS that's never diagnosed, never treated. The 90% who go to a doctor, they look at what percentage of those people get the right diagnosis. And here's a scary thought, it's not 100%. Let's say it's 80%. What about the other 20%? The doctor is a quack. He gives some diagnosis. You have the flu, go back home, it'll all go away in about 25 years. So now you've gone from 100 to 90 to 70 to 80% of 90. And then they look at what percentage of those people who are diagnosed with MS actually can take the drug. Why? Because you've got insurance, you've got healthcare costs, it'll be covered. So let's say half of those people. So that's how they build up to a market. It's like it's a spreadsheet, but it's a very morbid exercise. By the time you're done, you also have to decide what price you're going to charge for the drug. Martin Shkreli, he's going to say 500,000 a piece. Let's see how much money I can make next year. If you have no idea who I'm talking about, I think there's a Netflix show now you can watch. He's the Pharma Bro, I think is his name. Right? So type in Pharma Bro on Netflix. I'm sure you have nothing to do this evening. Watch it. But that gives you, and they didn't done the cash flow. The present value they got from developing the drug now was $3,422 million. Hang in there. They also estimated how much it would cost them to actually commercialize the drug. And remember, Avonex had no factories, no sales force. They estimated it would cost them $2,875 million to come up with the cost to develop the drug. So if I paused right there and said, present value of the cash flows is $5,422, the cost of developing the drug is $2,875. That difference of $547 million is a net present value. File that away. So in a DCF world, this drug would be worth $547 million. But remember, you haven't developed the drug yet. You have 17 years, there's optionality. The drug is viable, right? So if you wait a year, you're going to give up one out of the 17 years of protection. So that becomes your cost of delay. I value the option, and here's the magic of optionality. Now you can see why people get excited about options. You plug the numbers in, the value that I get for this drug as an option is $907 million. What was the net present value? $547 million. Where's the extra $360 million coming from? That's the time premium on the option. I'm actually, and this is really bad news if you have MS. You know why? Because developing the drug, you get 547 million. Leaving it undeveloped, treating it as an option, gets you 907 million. And in fact, I computed based on the cash flows when Avonex would develop this drug. And remember, it'll develop it only when the value of the option drops below the present value. And by my estimates, they won't develop it for the next 8 years. So here you are, you have MS, you're excited, this drug has been developed, and you're waiting and waiting and waiting. That's terrible, right? I agree. But in this case, the good news is Biogen developed the drug almost instantaneously, not out of the goodness of their hearts, but because of something that they saw on the horizon. In my option pricing model, what did I say the cost of delay was? 1/17. Implicitly, I was assuming you have 17 years of protection. Is that true though?
No.
Why not?
Because somebody else can.
Exactly. Merck was working on its own MS drug, and there was they thought in 4 years that drug would come out. You know what that's going to do to your cost and delay, right? Instead of being 1/17, you put in 1/4. That'll make the value of the option about 480 million, less than the present value. So if you're in a competitive pharmaceutical market, the optionality will not kick in. You lose the optionality. But if you're a monopoly pharmaceutical company, guess what you're going to do? You're going to take your time. It's actually an argument for increased competition in R&D, because the more you've got competitors working on drugs, the more likely you'll develop. Yeah.
So would this also mean, like, implicitly saying that drugs that, or conditions that have affect a very low number of patients?
It's not even low. Basically, if there are multiple players trying to come up with a drug for a disease,
Yeah. There,
you know. But if you have a very narrow disease that it doesn't pay for most people to drive, there's only one company working on it, you're going to develop it anyway, right? There's no point waiting there. What's the upside? But the pricing is going to be much higher because it's going to show up as much higher pricing because you have no competition. One final point, and then we'll end for the day. So if I ask you to value a pharmaceutical company, the way we talked about valuation is you get revenues, operating margins, you know, reinvestment, free cash flow. That's one way to do it. And if you have great drugs working through the pipeline, you show it as a higher growth rate in revenues, higher margins in the future. Here's another way you can value a pharma company. Do it only if you have a really small pharmaceutical company. You're going to see why. Value the existing products with a discounted cash flow model. Take the drugs that they have patented that they haven't developed, value them as options. And then as a third slice, take their existing R&D department, because remember, it's not done. It's trying to churn out more patents, and ask yourself, how much value will be added by R&D? I'm not saying it's easy to do, but it's a different way of building up to value. Okay? With Biogen, because I don't want to leave this untouched, they had existing drugs, two existing drugs that they'd licensed out, I think to Merck or Pfizer, one of the big pharma companies. And they licensed out with a fixed license fee. That's critical, because there are two ways you can license a drug. One is you can get a percentage of revenues. The other is you can set it for a fixed license fee. You're saying, who cares? If you get a fixed license fee and it's a contractual agreement, what's the only risk you face as Biogen on these cash flows?
Counterparty risk.
That Merck or Pfizer will go under. So you know what I use as my discount rate for the 50 million they're going to get on these cash flows? I use the pre-tax cost of debt of the pharmaceutical company that licensed the drug. In fact, let me ask you a final what if question, then we'll end for the day. What if Biogen had licensed this drug to the US government, let's say Medicare, and the US government had promised 50 million a year for the next 12 years? What did you use?
The 10 years?
Yeah.
10 year treasury.
Use the risk-free rate, right? Don't get too, what I'm trying to say is often we get so caught up in cost of capital that sometimes we forget there are some cash flows that you can apply a risk-free rate to discount, some you can use a pre-tax cost of debt. That becomes the value of the developed drug. So next session, when we start, I'm going to bring in the R&D part and finish the Biogen valuation. But it's a different way of thinking about the value of a pharmaceutical company or a company with patents.